Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensberry Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor from QueensberryRules.com. Also on the line, I have James Foley of BadLeftHookup.com. James?
Hey, what's up, man?
Not a whole lot, dude. It's kind of a slow couple weeks for boxing. I mean, not if you're a British fan, I suppose, but for American fans, it's been a little bit slow.
A lot of European action going on.
Tons. Absolutely tons.
Hang on one second. I'm just finishing up. I'm just G-chatting here with Coppinger for a second. How do you spell idol?
Okay.
I-D-O-L. Okay.
You know how to make the little smiley faces, right?
Yeah.
Just
I got it.
Sure. I mean, that's like code for, you know, it's all good.
Okay. Cool. So what's going
for
on?
For everybody listening, we're going to be joined by Brian Campbell of ESPN in about a half hour or so. And so that should be pretty cool. But in the meantime, I guess we'll just do a couple recaps, I suppose.
We expect Brian Campbell to be the recipient of the BWA Citizenship Award for many years to come. He really is one of the nicest guys in boxing media.
You know, I you and I were having a discussion earlier, and I won't get too far into it, but needless to say that there always seems to be a lot of, you know, kind of inter-site and inter-writer animosity and beefs and stuff like that in boxing. And I don't know, you normally don't really see that type of thing in other sports, and not saying it doesn't exist, but there definitely seems to be, you know, kind of bad feelings here and there. But Brian Campbell's the type of guy that he just doesn't really participate in that stuff, and it's kind of
yeah.
tough to get him to because he's such a nice guy.
No, you will never – I mean, a lot of times these situations just make us all look like assholes, but you will never see Brian Campbell involved in anything like that.
Nah, so. Probably not. Nice dude. But he should be pretty fun to have on the show today.
Yeah, I'm looking
forward to it. So I guess I wanted to briefly talk about what I thought was a pretty decent fight over the weekend in the UK, which was the rematch between Kell Brook and Carson Jones. It was a rematch of a kind of a tight fight. The first one was pretty entertaining, I thought, and Kell Brook is the type of guy who's kind of straight up, has a real good jab, very good jab. Not a ton of punching power, but enough to really sting you if he gets you in good position. So hopefully you saw that fight. If you didn't, then we're screwed.
Yeah, I did. I did see it. And, you know, it was a good win for Kell Brook, definitely. I mean, he needed to do that. I didn't really see the necessity of a rematch. I mean, the first fight was definitely close, and Jones gave him a hell of a fight. And, you know, this kind of came about after the Devin Alexander-Kell Brook fight got postponed and then canceled when I think Alexander was injured. So, you know, Brook did what he had to do. I mean, I think he, I thought it was an okay stoppage, and, you know, he got the better of it and got the TKO. So, you know, I guess on to bigger and better things. My question here, though, is I thought it was interesting that they fought this at a catch weight at like 151 or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I see Brook's prospects being a lot better at welterweight than junior middleweight. I'm not really sure why this fight was fought there.
I mean, I don't have the answer, but my guess would be just, I guess, so both guys could be more comfortable. But I really don't know. You know, I don't know why it was put in the contract or whatever. But in the wake of Kell Brook's win, he seems to be pretty eager to get it on with Devin Alexander. It seems to me like even though they obviously didn't fight, it seems almost like there's unfinished business on his side and he really wants it. Do you see that fight unfolding anytime soon?
I could see that happening. I'm not sure if they're going to proceed with Alexander against Amir Khan. Another thing I heard was maybe Kell Brook, Victor Ortiz, but it sounds like Golden Boy's planning on putting Brook in there with one of their welterweights, and I know Golden Boy's trying to expand into the UK markets. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's going to end up getting a fight with somebody. I'm not sure if it's Devin. I think a lot of people have doubts whether Brook's going to continue his winning ways on that level. But I think he's done enough to earn the shot.
Yeah, and, you know, he's the type of fighter that, at least from what I can see and, you know, from what I've seen of him, and I haven't seen a ton. I haven't really been, you know, a Kell Brook supporter or big follower necessarily, but I've seen enough, you know, to get a pretty good idea of what type of fighter he is. And to me, he just seems like the kind of guy who's pretty good at a number of things, only really good at one thing, which from what I can see is jabbing, which is very important and very effective, but he doesn't really wow in a lot of ways, which is fine. You know, you don't have to be a spectacular knockout artist to win and win effectively, but I do kind of have some doubts about how he fares against kind of world-class welterweights at this point. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I want to see it. I've got doubts too about it, but, you know, certainly Devin Alexander's not unbeatable, and that's a good fight. Sometime down the road, I know Amir Khan and Kell Brook have already had a little bit of a rivalry, and I think Khan kind of feels like he's above Brook's level, and he certainly was as a contender coming up, but now that he's been tarnished a little bit with the last couple of losses and his chin looks like a really big vulnerability at the moment, that's a fight that's interesting, and, you know, Brook's, I think, the bigger guy, so, and that would be a huge fight in the UK. So I don't know. I mean, do I think he's going to become like pound for pound number one welterweight champion? Probably not. But I think he can beat a couple of those guys on the fringe, or at least give them competitive fights. And, you know, I'd like to see that going forward.
Yeah, and it's. I think that he's definitely got an interesting style, and the type of style that can probably nullify a lot of more spectacular looking guys or guys who are a lot more talented than he is. Amir Khan being one of them. And plus, on top of that, when you add that Amir Khan's chin just does not really seem to be up to snuff lately, I think that probably sums it up for me for Amir Khan. I mean, I don't dislike the guy. I'll be watching him whenever he fights, but, you know, the chin, it's a liability.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of people were willing to kind of write off the Danny Garcia. I mean, that was just a hell of a punch, and Khan was getting the better of it up to that point. I mean, he was really starting to put it on Garcia in that second round of that fight. And, you know, he just took a huge punch that he didn't see coming. He hit him kind of right on the chin, on the side of the neck. And that wasn't, you know, the biggest, like, nail in the coffin. But to see what Julio Diaz did to him and what was supposed to be kind of a, you know, another bounce-back fight to get his confidence back, I mean, that's really troubling. I mean, Diaz had him not just knocking him around the ring, and Diaz was a lightweight at his best and not a huge puncher. A good puncher, but, you know, I kind of agree with you. I mean, I'd like to see Khan get back and be successful, because I think he's an exciting fighter and he's got a good style. And I like guys with bravado, hand speed, who jumps in there, and kind of fearless fighters. But with his chin, I mean, he just doesn't seem like a good style for him. But at the same time, like I was saying, I think on an earlier show, with Virgil Hunter training him, I'm not sure if being a kind of a cautious boxer puncher is a good style either. So I just think he needs to try to find some kind of a medium there. And you know, at his best, I mean, he just overwhelms guys with his offense, with volume of punches and hand speed. But obviously that leaves him vulnerable. But when he just kind of sits back and tries to box like he was doing against Julio Diaz, I mean, he let Diaz walk him down and end up catching him with some shots there too. So I don't know, man. I mean, I probably wouldn't buy stock in the rest of his career right now, but I'll be interested to see what he does going forward, because he does have certain tools and gifts that not many fighters have, just physically.
Well, since we're on the subject of Amir Khan, and might as well go with it, I guess, I have said on previous shows, and I've also said elsewhere, usually being Twitter, that I think that Amir Khan, in a way, almost reminds me a little bit of Vladimir Klitschko in his earlier career, kind of like the first, you know, incarnation of Vladimir Klitschko, in that he was a great offensive fighter. You know, he had very good hand speed, good power, moved pretty well, etc., but, you know, he could be hit and he could be hurt. You know, he suffered a couple stoppage losses. And then, you know, Manny Stewart, the late great Manny Stewart, basically retooled his offense so that, you know, he's obviously a much more, well, I'll put it out there, he's a much more boring fighter now, but he's also much more effective. And so, you know, while I don't necessarily encourage that type of style, I guess, because I want to see action just like everybody. At the same time, if Amir Khan is going to be seriously looking at, you know, looking at pushing his career forward and going places, he ought to think about, you know, adding some clinch game and some inside work into his style, because he doesn't really have much.
Yeah. And it's a comparison that I'd heard made, too. I think the problem with it is that Khan will never be able to physically outmatch his opponents the way that Klitschko can with, like, height and reach and things like that. I mean, Khan's biggest asset is speed. And so he's not, you know, it's just a different kind of a style. I mean, I think that's a valid point to say, you know, Klitschko was knocked out. He pulled it together and then dominated the heavyweight division for 7 years or whatever it is. I don't know if a smaller fighter can do that, because you're going to be fighting guys who are just as big as you. And, you know, I don't know, man. I mean, you know, it's like, it's tough not to be pessimistic about where he goes from here. But, you know, I think the Alexander fight could be exciting. And, or, you know, at least be an interesting fight that'll put one of them further up the welterweight ranks. So, I'm looking forward to that if that gets made. Has there been any news on that?
I'm sorry, what's that? What was the last part?
Oh, I was saying, has there been any news on Khan Alexander? Because it was, you know, being talked about a lot a few weeks ago, and I don't think I'd ever heard that was actually official, but it seemed like that was what Golden Boy's plan for those guys.
I personally haven't read anything official on it myself, but I mean, you know, it's the type of, well, I mean, look at Garcia Matisse, where we've gone back and forth on whether or not the fight's happening at all, and then what date it's happening, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, unfortunately in boxing, the whole negotiating process is a process. It's not quite like the old days where a fight needed to get made and it got made for the most part. So I haven't really heard much myself past that's what they're looking to do. Personally, I'm not really sure that Alexander's style is that great for Amir Khan either, but I guess we'll see.
Right, yeah, and I mean, and I think that's the right kind of move for Golden Boy. You know, I mean, obviously we want to see Garcia and Matisse. I'd like to see Broner and Maidana, Khan and Alexander. I mean, if they're putting all their guys in with each other, that's the right move. We don't want to see Garcia, Zab Judah 2, and Broner, Malinaji 2, and things like that. So I guess we just have to wait and see what they actually end up doing.
Yeah, there's in the last like two or three days, there's been some stuff about Paul Malignaggi calling Adrian Broner a brat and calling him like a pussy and stuff like that for not wanting a rematch. But you know, maybe I'm in the minority. I don't think I am, but I'm not really all that interested in that rematch either. I didn't really see it as a super duper close fight.
No.
I don't really know how Malignaggi could improve on that.
I didn't see that as being a close fight at all. I mean, if you give a guy a couple rounds because he's more active and the other guy's, you know, Broner's just not throwing a whole lot of punches, okay, maybe you come up with like an 8-4 scorecard, but it wasn't close. I mean, every time they engaged, Broner got the better of it. He blocked and dodged all of his punches, hit him with clean shots all night. And, you know, all his clowning and his antics and all that shit aside, and the fact that I think a lot of people expected that Broner was going to just blow him away, because Paulie's older and he's slowed down a little bit, and he has been stopped, TKO'd by volume in the past. I think there was some expectation that Broner would have, you know, a better performance and end up stopping him, and that didn't happen. But it doesn't take away the fact that, I mean, I really thought Broner dominated most of that fight. I see no reason for a rematch. You know, and as far as Judah and Garcia, I mean, that was a little bit closer, but still, I mean, Garcia, you know, there's just no need for a rematch in that situation, I don't think. Just because a guy got hot the last couple rounds and caught him with a punch and kind of hurt him, I mean, it wasn't like a Martinez-Chavez. Garcia was never on his way out of the fight or anything like that. I think he just gassed late and was surprised that Zab Judah, not really known for his resiliency, was still there and still giving him a fight. Because Judah had been hurt badly early, you know, in the middle rounds, and at times stumbling around the ring looked like he was a couple punches from being stopped. But, you know, neither of those fights need rematches. I mean, it's time for Golden Boy to really step up and put their best fighters in with the other best fighters, and there's great matchups to be made.
Yeah, it's really a no-brainer. I mean, I can see that some Malignaggi fans wanted to have him winning that fight or wanted to have him winning more rounds than, you know, most people seem to think that he won. But, I mean, Adrian Broner, and I've been hard on the guy pretty much ever since he rose to prominence. But at the same time, he landed the harder punches, the more effective punches, pretty much throughout the fight, even if he landed fewer punches in many rounds. So, you know, you have to look at stuff like that, I think. But, yeah, I'm not interested really in those type of rematches. I'd rather see the best fight the best, especially when there's no roadblocks. You know, the same promoters
right.
or the same advisors, managers, et cetera, there's no roadblocks there. They need to happen.
The thing about both of those is I thought Judah and Malignaggi both put on just inspiring performances in those fights. I thought they both fought for Judah to come back and do what he did late and for Malignaggi to give the effort that he gave. You know, I thought both those guys fought great, but they clearly lost. So I feel like we've already seen them, you know, the best versions of where they're at right now lose to these guys. So, it's time to get the young fighters fighting each other and really get some clarity in the division. But you never know what to believe. What's your thoughts on this, like, Bob Arum saying that HBO isn't interested in Rigondo and all that stuff? I mean, I think that's kind of the same type of situation, just that we see all these stories. I mean, you have to take everything with a grain of salt. Who knows if what fights are actually being negotiated or whether what any of these guys say is true. But I would put money that Rigondo's next fight will be on HBO in some form or another.
You know, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because I did want to talk about that today. I do find Guillermo Rigondo, for the most part, entertaining. Not all the time, not in every single round that he's ever fought. And there have been times where I thought that he moved a little bit too much or waited or posed or flinched and stuff like that a little bit too much. Like against Marroquin, he was a little bit too squirrely sometimes. But at the same time, you know, I feel like the consensus is that most people don't really care whether or not he's put on TV. And personally, I kind of disagree because I think that there's room for a whole lot of styles in boxing. And I think that it's he'll probably wind up getting put on HBO. That's my guess. But
He's going to be on HBO. I mean, you look at the segment that they devoted on the fight game with Jim Lampley where Max Kellerman is touting Rigondo as the number 3 or 4 pound for pound. To me, that's a better indication that HBO is invested in this guy than whatever Bob Arum is saying to try to – I mean, who knows what his angle is. But, you know,
I don't have a horse in this race. You know, I'm not pro Golden Boy or pro Top Rank, anti-Golden Boy, you know, whatever. I just want to see, like, you know, the guys that I find fun to watch or the guys that are skilled and have, you know, won fights and deserve their shots.
Right. But do you want
so
to also
me,
bet the best fighters?
What's that?
I mean, but do you also want to see the best fighters in the world or the best fighters at a weight class? I mean, because I think Rigondo established himself as that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are times when, you know, when you make a fight – and the best fighters also wind up happening, you know, it winds up being an exciting fight as well. Not always, but at the same time, the bottom line for me is that, like I was saying, I'm not anti-Top Rank or anti-Golden Boy or anything like that, but I also find it just kind of shitty of Bob Arum and of Top Rank to just come out even right after the Donaire win. Right after he, you know, basically dominated a guy that was supposed to be in the top couple pound for pound, you know,
yeah.
Right after the win, they come out and they're like, we don't really want to promote this guy. And I'm kind of thinking, well, isn't that your job? Isn't your job to take guys who are difficult to promote and promote them, you know, make people care? That's your job.
Yeah, and I think a big problem with that is that a lot of the media covering that fight was telling – you know, was speaking out at ringside saying, oh, this was such a boring, dreadful performance. You know, meanwhile, I mean, Rigondo does that to Nonito Donaire, who's like clearly a top 5 pound for pound guy who established a great track record over the last few years. Meanwhile, Floyd Mayweather does what he does against Robert Guerrero, and it's just a unanimous boxing masterpiece. I mean, because so much of this has to do with politics. There's no, you know, you're criticizing Rigondo. There's no risk to it. He doesn't have a fan base. He's not a big popular fighter. You know, I mean, his own promoter is willing to turn on him and badmouth him, you know, at the sway of the wind. You know, but Mayweather, I mean, he's a boxer. He's not exciting. He's methodical. He does the same types of things that Rigondo does. He uses defense and takes one shot at a time, and he's not going for knockouts or going to try to get into exciting exchanges. but he's at the top of the sport, and rightfully so. But I mean, you know, there should just be the same standard when you're talking about great boxers. Rigondeaux's right there, and if you're going to hail Mayweather doing what he did against Guerrero, who, in all honesty, you know, top 10 welterweight, not a great pound for pound level talent, Rigondeaux does this to Nonito Donaire. I mean, give him some credit. You know, if the fight was bad, blame the guy who lost almost every round.
Well, and on top of that, I think that there just needs to be consistency. You know, I mean, no offense to Nonito Donaire, because I actually enjoyed watching him fight for the most part, too. But he's turned in a number of kind of crappy performances, you know, before
sure.
before taking out, who was it, Nishioka? Or, yeah, wasn't it Nishioka? I was there,
yeah.
But it was,
yeah,
you
Nishioka.
Know, the boos were like drowning out every sound in the
Well, that was a bad fight
center.
For the first four or five rounds, and a lot of it was because Nishioka
yeah,
wasn't
was
opening up at all.
It was terrible. And so, you know.
But I'll never
yeah,
blame a guy
not,
for dominating
totally
his opponent.
Blaming.
Yeah, I mean,
sure.
I won't blame
I'm
a guy
not,
for dominating an opponent without taking any punishment. If the opponent's going to be in
yeah,
a shell
not,
all night moving backward, I mean, that's.
Definitely. I'm not going to blame Donaire for that, but at the same time, you know, there have been a number of performances that were kind of ho-hum from him, too. Yet Top Rank stood by him pretty steadfastly, and HBO was willing to put in, you know, promotional time, essentially, for him. So I just don't really see why all of a sudden it's an issue, because there have been a number of fighters in the recent past that HBO was standing by, like, for example, Andre Berto, who was taking on some, you know, fairly crappy opponents on HBO airwaves, and they stood by him. So in any event, I just want some consistency, that's all.
I would be stunned if Rigondeaux doesn't end up back on HBO. I'd be shocked. I mean,
I hope so. I hope so, because I think he's earned it.
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, I know that we're over here talking crap on Friday night fights pretty much every week, but that said, this last week's Friday night fights was actually pretty decent.
Well, we're big fans of Griffey.
yeah, we're huge fans of Todd Grisham, of course. But, yeah, last week's card was actually pretty decent. I didn't expect it to be that way on paper, actually. And so I guess that just kind of goes to show you that just because a fight looks a certain way on paper doesn't mean it's going to turn out a certain way in real life.
Yeah, this was a good show. Definitely. And I thought the undercard was good, the Glenn Tapia fight, and, you know, it was a bit one-sided, but that Abi Han guy, I mean, just showed a ton of heart. I mean, he looked like, you know, the types of punches. At moments, it kind of resembled that Delvin Rodriguez fight earlier this season. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the guy's last name, but George Tadanupa. Guess I am going to try.
Yeah,
but, yeah, at times it looked like, I mean, he was outclassed and he was just going to take a brutal beating. And I guess he ended up kind of doing that. But he had plenty of moments of his own, and he just showed a ton of resilience. And it was an exciting fight, a good fight to watch. And main event was good, too. Now, I don't know where Avalos fits in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, these are good, entertaining fights to have on.
And, you know, I got to say, for Abi or Abi Han, I'm not sure exactly how he pronounces his first name, but regardless – yeah, he was getting dinged around for a lot of the fight, and I mean you have to love when a guy is. I mean, I'm not saying that I love one-sided fights, but it was kind of a pretty fun one-sided fight as far as one-sided fights go.
Yeah, and you know, didn't he catch Tapia with a body shot at the end of one of those rounds? It almost kind of bent him in half. It looked like
he had a moment
where he hurt him, but there was like no time left on the round, and he recovered pretty quickly and. So
yeah,
it was a good,
good
fight.
I think he was a little bit lucky that was at the end of the round and not, you know, at the beginning of the round, because he looked fairly hurt by that shot.
Yeah.
And so I got to hand it to Abi Han for sticking in there. But, you know, and on top
and
of that,
and also for having a super cute sister. Also, Han's sister cheering him on from the crowd. I mean, she was one of the kind of, you know, hidden superstars of that show, too.
There you go. Talent all around. It was solid. You know, we talk shit about Friday Night Fights, you know, fairly regularly, but I have to give it up when it's a good show. So
yeah,
you
know, I think I
appreciate it.
You want a good action fight, or you want to see somebody special who's, you know, a legitimate prospect who has a chance to become great. most of the shows don't fall into that, but I mean, a lot of them do, you know, so.
Cool. I can't remember who it was who tweeted it. Gosh, I wish I could remember at this point, because I should be giving them proper credit, but somebody tweeted a link that was basically breaking down the payment scale of all the fighters on this last Friday
that.
Night fight.
Yeah.
You know, the
Brent,
purpose.
Brookhouse.
That's who it was. Thank you.
Bad
yes.
left hook.
Brent Brookhouse.
And Bloody Elbow. Yeah.
Yeah. His the MMA site that he, I believe, edits for. And so I think that once you look at that and start to realize that what these guys are getting paid for Friday night fights, you know, cards in general, you know, there was something like the main event fighters made something like $5,000. And so when you break that down and you kind of start to realize that these guys are paying for training expenses, you know, I kind of doubt that their flights and their hotels and stuff like that are all paid for because they're not big fighters. So when you X out all those types of things, they're not really taking home that much money. It's
yeah.
almost as if they're paying to be on TV. And so, you know, I kind of, you know, when I look at stuff like that, I start to almost feel bad about talking shit about Friday night fights, because they're kind of doing the best they can with what they have to work with, which is not much.
Right. And we're not talking shit. I mean, but this is a big problem with boxing.
I'm exaggerating, but.
Yeah, I mean, but this is, again, the problem with boxing is, like, it's all about the TV fees and license fees and the gap between ESPN and then Showtime undercard or Showbox and then HBO. I mean, it's enormous. So it's like you're either guys making $1 million or guys making $25,000. And there's, like, no real middle ground. And so that's why you see fighters who it's like they will only fight on HBO or they will only fight, you know, once or twice a year when the two spots open up on one of the premium networks. Because it's not worth it to take fights off those networks. The paydays are just a fraction of what they'll make.
I mean, yeah, it was kind of like a discussion that I was getting into earlier with a couple people about Garcia Matisse potentially being on the Floyd Mayweather versus Canelo Alvarez undercard.
Yeah.
Where the guys that I was talking to were doubting that it would happen. And, you know, I'm not super hopeful about it myself. I've, you know, almost given up the ghost that it will happen. But at the same time, you know, I don't really buy the argument that it's not viable, it doesn't make sense financially, et cetera. For guys like that who don't really have a huge fan base, and from what I can tell, aren't drawing huge crowds by themselves, you know, I think that guys like that would really love the opportunity to fight on the undercard of a pay-per-view that could potentially have, you know, 1.5 million, 1.7 you know, million buys.
Absolutely.
So, you
yeah,
know,
I mean, there will be more eyes on
that. With,
yeah.
Yeah, and then to contrast that with, you know, Friday night fights, at the end of the day, it's basically these guys, you know, just trying to get their names out there. And it's kind of the same thing for Garcia and Matisse, except obviously on a larger scale. But, you know, I just kind of have a respect for guys who are coming up in that way.
I mean, I think it's a great idea to put it on that card. You know, I mean, they popped the pay-per-view up $5, and that's, I'm sure, just because the main event is so captivating and they know they're going to get a lot of buys, and that doesn't really matter. And, you know, that adds up when you're talking about 1.5 million, 2 million buys. But you look at that, and I know half the money goes to the cable systems, but, you know, let's just say it gets 1.5 million buys there. I mean, that's like, what, $7.5 million more in revenue? And you cut that in half, I mean, you almost have $4 million. I mean, that sounds about right for what Matisse and Garcia would get to fight each other.
Yeah,
so,
they're,
I mean,
not going to
money there.
Really huge person yet.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, that Canelo is going to get a much bigger payday than most of Floyd's opponents. And obviously Floyd wants his payday. So, you know, the money might be tough, but, you know, you can't squeeze out another $3 or $4 million when you're talking about an event that's going to do almost $100 million in revenue to get a great fight on
yeah.
the undercard that'll have people talking. And oh, the other thing is just like, you know, when, I mean, this is going to be a big event that like casual sports fans are going to go to their friends' houses and order and watch. And like I said before, there's always like one boxing guy at those type of events. And that guy will say, you guys have to watch this undercard, Matisse and Garcia. And they're going to get like 10 times as many eyeballs on them there as they would on a Showtime main event that'll maybe have 1 million viewers live. So I think it's a great opportunity to build a star, build somebody, you know, who would be an attractive opponent for Floyd in the future.
Well, it's like I said when I was speaking about it earlier, but basically if I were Garcia or Matisse, I would be really scrambling to get on that undercard because I would want, you know, potentially a million or however many people. It's probably not going to be the full, you know, amount of the buys because not everybody's watching and, you know, some people don't really pay attention to the card until the main event, et cetera, et cetera. But even that, like if it's just 1 million people, many of whom are casual fans, and it winds up being a really good fight or a competitive fight or whatever, that's a lot of really good exposure. So for me, it makes perfect sense, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and if somebody does something, I mean, something spectacular, and the way I look at Matisse and Garcia, I don't see it being a brawl, but I see that as a fight that could end at any moment because I think both guys can punch, and I think it's a fight where somebody's getting hurt and probably ends in some kind of a spectacular knockout one way or the other. And that's the kind of thing that next year, you know, assuming Floyd keeps winning, you know, point back to your casual friends. Remember the guy who, you know, took this guy, decapitated this dude on the Canelo undercard? That's who's fighting Floyd.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great way to sell the future fights, too.
Well, you know, there was kind of the talk about Matisse, and I don't want to say anybody was really bashing Matisse before the Lamont-Peterson fight, because I didn't really see any of that. But at the same time, I think that he was kind of downgraded a bit before that fight. But then all it took was that one fairly spectacular stoppage against a guy that many felt was a big-name player and a dangerous guy in the division. And there was a shitload of talk about him after that. There was a lot. So if he were to be on an undercard like that, yeah, I just don't see it being a lose-lose situation at all, you know?
Well, no, I mean, you want to create, like, memories that people, you know, stick with people. Because ultimately, the promoters are just trying to make money, and they're trying to sell fights. I mean, to me, this is the way to do it. Put it on the biggest event of the year. Let people see it. It's a fight that deserves to be seen by that many people. I mean, those are the highest-rated Showtime ever, in recent years. The highest-rated Showtime was Cotto against Trout, and I think it was, like, 1.25 million viewers live. Something like that. I mean, it wasn't a huge, staggering number by any means. So this is something, you know, if you're getting whatever, you know, 1.5 to 2 million pay-per-view buys, and that's not some guy sitting solo at his house. I mean, most of these are parties where there's, you know, 5 to 10 people at least. I mean, you're just getting a lot of people, a lot of exposure for those guys, and that's great, I think.
Yeah, I don't see how it could be bad.
It can't be
bad. And before... No,
by the way, Campbell...
Not unless it's a terrible fight.
I don't see those guys stinking out the joint against each other, you know? I mean...
Yeah, I doubt it.
It's just not going to happen. I mean, if... I don't necessarily see it to be any kind of a great war, but I think it'll be something memorable.
Yeah, well, I don't really see it lasting the distance with what looked to be Garcia's kind of... I mean, I'm not going to call his, you know, endurance crap or anything like that, but he seems to fade as the fight goes on, whereas Matisse seems to kind of gain steam. So, and on top of that, Matisse has been starting a little bit quicker lately. So I'm not really sure I see that fight going the distance. But what were you going to say about Mr. Campbell?
Well, he just said he's going to be 4 minutes late.
Not a
which
problem.
Which is right about now, I think. He should be turning
up.
Yeah,
pretty close. Cool. Oh, and actually, I believe that is him. Let me patch him through. Mr. Campbell?
This is I.
Brian.
How's it going, sir?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. It was a great pleasure. I'm doing well. How about yourselves?
Great. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, much better now that you're here, sir.
I'm sure it's a tremendous honor for you.
No, it really is. Two of my favorites on Twitter. Come on.
Thanks.
Come on, guys.
Well, we appreciate it, man. We really do. So we were just on the subject of Danny Garcia versus Lucas Matisse, you know, potentially being on the undercard of Floyd Mayweather versus Canelo Alvarez. So, I mean, what do you see? Do you think that that's even possible at this point? Is time kind of like drawn too short for that to even happen? And if it does happen, you know, is there anything about that that just doesn't make sense? Because Mr. Foley and I were trying to find it and we couldn't.
Well, I don't really have any scientific reasons to back this up, but I think the delay helps the chance of it being on the undercard, because this is going to be a difficult situation to schedule. I mean, you're putting a legit main event fight, maybe not on the pay-per-view level. Maybe, you know, I mean, you can argue it'd be a small pay-per-view, but a legit main event fight on the biggest pay-per-view in, you know, 6-7 years. So what that says is two things to me. It says that Oscar and Richard Schaefer, Golden Boy, are really making a run at trying to make this the record breaker. It also says that they have plans for Floyd to want to put him in big competitive fights. So, you know, you showcase this, maybe they assume Lucas Matisse rolls through Danny Garcia like a lot of us do, and maybe now suddenly Matisse, who obviously has the street cred, obviously is such a must-see attraction to boxing's, you know, hardcore guys, this gives him the potential platform to you know, I mean, you can't get a gig like this to be the fight before Mayweather-Canelo to get that kind of exposure, and then the whole world awaits, whoa, who's this Matisse guy? Imagine him against Mayweather. So I don't think you put him in that spot unless you think you're going to try to set him up against Mayweather in the next fight.
Yeah, and maybe Richard Schaefer's comments after the Peterson knockout were telling when he said, this is the next Manny Pacquiao.
Exactly.
And who did everyone want to see Manny Pacquiao fight?
That's a great call, and to them it's a homegrown talent. I mean, I know they signed him relatively late in the process, but it's a homegrown talent for them. It's a stick up Bob's, you know, kazoo, and it's sort of like, I mean, what? And I know we can't go long on that, but that was one of the greatest sound bites in the history of boxing. Let's be honest. When Richard just slobbered all over the mic, just like, hey, look, I got a toast to make here. You know, it's like, all right, Uncle Rich, just, you know, relax a little bit here.
Can I ask you, because you said, you know, the Matisse roll over Garcia like a lot of us expect. Is that what
yes.
you expect?
I ultimately expect a Matisse victory by stoppage, yes. I have a lot of respect for Danny, and I'm, you know, I've been so skeptical of him, but he always, you know, he always proves himself. I thought it's funny in that Judah fight, because the first six rounds, especially the sixth round right around there, I was like, wow, he's even better than I thought he was. I mean, he was putting it on Judah. I mean, he just looked great. We know his left hook is there, but he was just punching with both hands. Just the setup to the punches was great. And then, you know, he has that second half where it's just like, whoa, this maybe this guy, you know, is who we thought he was. So with that said, and that's kind of a long-winded setup, I think he would do better than a lot of us are jumping to believe. So I think he would make that a good fight for a while, you know, because he's, you know, we always say that he's 75% good in all his categories. You know, he's really good. He's not great. Well, he's good enough, I think, to make that a good fight. But you can't, if you're going to be tested by Judah and almost get stopped, you're not getting through 12 with the machine. Come on. We know this, right?
Well, let's remember, Judah went 12 with the machine. I mean, just playing devil's advocate. He's gotten better since
that's a good
then,
point.
I think. But I'm very interested to see. I mean, if Danny can land some big shots on Matisse, I just would be interested to see how that will play out.
Right. And I think my automatic response to, well, he, you know, yeah, he went 12 with this guy and this guy, is I want to make myself believe that he's a different fighter now from getting what he believes is screwed over in two scorecards, you know, in those two fights. That he's now like, I got to put this in my hands and I have to press more, I have to throw more power punches. I mean, that doesn't mean that he punches harder now than he did then, I guess, but I just sort of, you know, believe that he is a more confident fighter and a more damaging, more demolishing fighter than he was even then.
Yeah,
well, he's certainly starting earlier. No, I was just saying,
definitely.
Basically what I was saying earlier to you was that he's certainly starting earlier. And, I mean, I do see a case that he really could have in reality lost the fight to Zab Judah. I personally thought Matisse took it close. But, you know, he did start kind of late, and so I'm not going to really begrudge anybody for having Judah winning that fight. But regardless, I did think that he beat Devin Alexander fairly clearly, and he certainly does, and he's fighting like he really believes that. And so I think that that's an interesting point as well, that, you know, that it does seem that he has changed his mindset a little bit.
Yeah, he don't need no stinking judges, and he's not, and he's acting like that. You know, he's acting like his hands are going to be the only one that decides it, and I don't think Danny can get past that.
People like are perceiving the Lamont Peterson fight, because it was definitely a great win for him, you know, but Peterson's not really an elite talent. He's a tough guy, but you know, he'd also been knocked down a few times in previous fights too. I mean, Victor Ortiz may have been a few punches away from stopping him in the early rounds as well. So I don't know. I mean, I do believe that this is a fight that these guys will be each other's best opponents. And obviously, Matisse is a horrifying opponent for Danny Garcia, but I think Garcia is probably Matisse's best as well. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's just interesting how we glean these opinions on fighters based on such small samples of fighting once or twice a year.
Good call. Yeah, we ride the waves of momentum. I mean, we definitely do. You know, we're not all fanboys, but we, you start seeing a guy put some fights together, you start feeling like he can start. You know, I mean, this is funny. We're drinking the juice of Matisse and Golovkin so hard, it's hard not to, and it's fun. Like Mike, I have twin sons, 5 years old. They're not allowed to watch boxing, but I slipped it and let them watch a little bit of the replay of Golovkin. And my son, and it was awesome. It was this great dad moment, you know. I mean, I don't want them at this age getting into it. But he watched it and he goes, "Whoa, Dad, do you think Golovkin could climb buildings?" And that was his natural response. And I was like, "Wow!"
And your natural response was, "Yes, son, he can climb buildings with his fists."
I said, "You're damn right." And that's exactly like, "Are you kidding me? Of course he can, son. Believe in this guy. Oh, wow, you know." And it's hard not to get caught up in it.
Well, and maybe the perception of this fight would be different, too, had Garcia finished the job on Zab Judah in the sixth or seventh round when he'd really dominated that fight early and had him hurt a couple times and seemed pretty close to doing that. Those last 4 or 5 rounds when he lost his focus and got hit with a couple punches and seemed like he got a little bit hurt and let Judah come back and win some late rounds, it definitely affects our perception of Garcia going forward.
Yeah, that was the worst thing that could happen, Judah deciding to cash out right there, you know, and have his last stand. Like, that's the worst thing for Danny's confidence, I think, and the worst thing for our confidence in him. I mean, do you think he gets stopped? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that also that, and then coupled with the, you know, the last month or so of, you know, damn near everybody calling Danny Garcia ducker and blah, 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 and, you know, whatever, name a word, and he's been called it in the last month or so. And so I think that, just like you said, we kind of ride the waves of momentum, and that's kind of one of the current waves right now, is that, you know, very few people seem to believe that Danny Garcia has the intestines to make the fight and is scared or is whatever. So I think that also kind of plays a part as well.
Yeah, it probably wasn't a great idea for him to stand up and look like he just crapped his pants in the reaction shot to Matisse knocking out Peterson. That didn't inspire a lot of confidence either.
It's one of the great faces in boxing. I mean, that was a great face at that moment. Oh, wow.
What was great is, like, he was trying to kind of recover and give, like, the little, like, put his finger up.
Yeah,
you know, the one. And,
it's okay. Philly's in the house. We got this. No, you don't have it.
But I don't know if you remember, but Kid Chocolate was, like, standing next to him and just had, like, the funniest look on his face, was just like, damn, you know, like, and meanwhile, Garcia's, like, trying to posture for the camera and looked a little shaken.
Because I think we've all been... go ahead, I'm stepping all over you.
No, you're the guest. You're here to step all over us.
I just feel like we've all been kind of afraid that maybe Golden Boy would go the real safe route with him, you know, because that Morales rematch was unnecessary. It wasn't Garcia's fault because Morales had the right in contractually and he kicked it in. But I think we're all like, you know, is he just going to rematch Judah again? Is he just going to rematch Khan again? Is he just going to go down these roads? And I don't think that he's going to duck Matisse. I think this is all a contract. Let's see if we can get this on the undercard situation that's holding this up. Because if he ducks in this situation, that's the end of his reputation, right? I mean, and Danny's been a stand-up guy in every sense of the word, in and out of the ring. So I think he has to take this.
Yeah, he doesn't strike me. I mean, well, let's kind of get something, you know, quickly out of the way, just for anybody who's not maybe a hardcore fan or is a hardcore fan and truly believes that fighters are afraid of one another. For the most part, I don't really believe that most fighters are afraid of anybody.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a certain type of confidence to really be a successful fighter. And so I don't really think that, you know, for guys calling fighters pussies and this and that, I'm not really with it. That said, I mean, there's just kind of like this air of, you know, like it's kind of all adding up to that shot right after the Matisse Peterson KO, where it just doesn't look good. Even if it's not true that, you know, nobody's afraid of nobody and blah, blah, blah. It just, there's a certain perception. And so people buy into that perception. So
yeah.
I hope that it's the type of fight that they can get made, because it's a really good fight for boxing.
And you make a great point. He's not afraid. What he might be afraid of is knowing that he has one chance to face Floyd Mayweather Jr. in a legitimate pay-per-view, and that's if he's the undefeated 140-pound champion moving up, right? I mean, that's really it.
Yeah.
So do you want to go the safe route, maybe beat Conor in a rematch, and preserve yourself for Floyd? That's really the only – you know, he's not afraid of him. He's a professional fighter, but you're right.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point. And, you know, that's the thing. It's a huge risk and not that much reward because, I mean, if he beats Matisse, it's not like, oh, okay, you just tripled your payday in a potential Mayweather fight. It's not going to work like that. I mean, he's not
right.
becoming a superstar overnight. No one out in the casual fans even really knows Matisse. In boxing circles, yeah, it's huge. I mean, if you beat Matisse, we would hype the crap out of a potential Floyd Mayweather fight. I mean, that's a huge win for either of those two guys. But, you know, it's not like he needs to win that fight, and then that's going to give him some kind of leverage against Mayweather. He's still going to be the clear B side if that ever happens.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And Brian, can I ask you on that subject? I've been asking a few people. What do you give Canelo any kind of chance to upset the apple cart in September?
Do I give him a chance? Do I give him a chance? You know, I don't give him a chance to outbox him. No, I don't give him a huge chance to one punch KO Floyd because. You know, Canelo's not that type of puncher in a one-punch setting. Floyd is not that type of fighter that gets hit in a one-punch setting. So what am I saying here? No, he's not going to win. My thing is more, can he make it really competitive and give himself an argument that he may have deserved a decision so that it's worth the money to the fans and that we can maybe get a second one out of it only if it's worth it? Because, and so how does that happen? He's, you know, can this be the fight where Floyd shows a little bit more age than he ever has, mixed with the fact that maybe Canelo's a little bit better than we think he was, or think he is, because I didn't think he was as good as he looked at times against Trout. So is he just getting better? Is he a little better than we think he is? Can he be the one for the first time that knocks Floyd down once, maybe twice, and can put himself in a position where you can make a jaded argument that he deserved six rounds or deserved, you know, a portion of that scorecard? That's what I'm looking at more. I don't think straight up he really can beat him in any way.
I think a good comparison, can he do better than what Oscar did?
Exactly. It's a great comparison, right?
Well, since you guys brought that up, then this has, at least for me, come up a couple times in the last maybe week or two in regards to discussing Mayweather-Canelo. In that I've heard a handful of people say stuff like, oh, well, if Oscar De La Hoya can almost beat Floyd Mayweather, you know, then what is Canelo going to do to him? How did you guys have that fight? Because personally, I thought it was a little closer to like a 9-3 for Floyd than a 7-5 or like a barely win or something like that.
Yeah, I'm all with you on that. I mean, that's an 8-4 in my mind, you know, because Oscar, you know, he's doing so good in the beginning, and he did so good at convincing you he was doing better than he was just by, you know, slapping Floyd's midsection, cornering him and cutting off the ring nicely. But it was when Oscar made that decision to forego his jab because he had to make a decision, am I potentially going to get knocked out or am I going to go to the scorecards and, you know, and save face? And I think that's what a lot of people are put in that position when you're getting hit with so many right hands and flush in a row over and over again like he was in the second half of that fight. So, yeah, that was a hometown. Oscar being, you know, Mr. Las Vegas for his career, got the hometown scorecard to make that a split decision so that maybe they could do a second one, which I'm so glad they didn't. But that's an 8-4 fight.
Well, and a lot of people forget that maybe about, I think it was, I can't remember exactly how many months it was, into Floyd's quote-unquote retirement. But the rumor was that he was going to come back for a little while for a De La Hoya rematch. And
yeah, that was
that got shut down pretty quick, you know, places like Twitter they went nuts.
Yeah, and I have faith in humanity that did get shut down because that was such an ultimate money grab. It was ridiculous. You know, there's no way Oscar was ever going to improve on that performance. That was a, hey, look, he got a split decision. Maybe he wins it this time. No, he's not going to win it. Come on. He's on the way out. Like, I'm so happy that fight didn't happen, just like I'm so happy that the immediate Pacquiao-Bradley rematch did not happen as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just going to say that that kind of led into, you know, Brian, we were talking about, I'd asked if you had any ideas for the show, stuff to talk about. And I liked your question, has there been, like, a definitive, like, what is the best fight since Corrales Castillo? And
exactly,
I thought about that. You know, and immediately I'm thinking about, like, the Vasquez-Marquez fights, which were awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think, you know, like, the fact that we didn't get the Pacquiao-Bradley instant rematch, I would argue maybe created what has been the best fight since Corrales Castillo in Pacquiao-Marquez 4, or Marquez-Pacquiao 4. Not for sustained action by any means, but I think historically, like 50 years from now, I think that's the fight from that, from this period, that's really going to stand out as just being an all-time classic. In terms of historical significance too, Pacquiao being knocked out. Do you guys have anything to weigh in on? What were you thinking when you asked the question?
I got a lot to weigh on it. First of all, you're damn right, James Foley. That's the best answer I ever heard, because it's my exact answer. And I pitched that to you because we got that question this week on a Twitter question for our Making the Round show on ESPN.com, and I was thinking about it. And the only answer is this Marquez, you know, Pacquiao 4 fight, because – and I think in some way – let me go on a little side tangent here. This fight is almost typecasted by the fact that it ended so stunningly with Pacquiao face down, that people stole that storyline from it too much, and they forget how unbelievable of a fight it was. You know, the back and forth, two guys, there was so much on the line historically within that rivalry, and here was two guys literally going toe-to-toe and willing to sell out, you know, in that moment for that fight, that I think, too, you know, so many people afterwards were just focused so much on, is Pacquiao done? You know, that whole storyline, which is important, people just were forgetting this was as good a fight as anyone has ever seen. I mean, I've never been as emotionally moved watching a fight than I have. You know, this one's right up there with all those Gotti awards, all those other ones, in terms of just being jaw-dropping, needing 1 to 2 minutes to collect my thoughts to even know what to say next. In fact, one of my favorite stories from that fight is about 20 minutes after it was over, I texted Karen Mulvaney, who was ringside, and I was just like, sum it up in one sentence. Just tell me something. Give me something from what you just saw. And he goes, that's impossible. You want to call me right now? And at like 1 in the morning, we were like giddy schoolgirls yelling at the top of our lungs, like, oh, my God, did you do that? What was it like? And it was just like, that never happens anymore. That's, you know, and it felt that good. And the reason why it felt that good was because when do you ever get two top 5 pound-for-pound fighters who are already Hall of Fame guys, who have that deep of a rivalry built up, who produce that kind of a fight? And then the cherry on top is that it ended so stunning, so dramatic, so violent with the face-down Pacquiao knockout. I mean, it has every, you know, I sometimes argue, well, what if Marquez didn't get the knockout there? Would that have gone 12 and been the best action fight we ever saw? Or, you know, maybe it would have gone downhill from there. But it was just the perfect ending for being one of the most ridiculous fights ever, and that's the correct answer right there, James Foley.
All right, thanks.
I don't disagree with you guys when I think that you add a number of different elements into it. When you start adding in, like, the historical significance, you know, the popularity of both fighters, the fact that there was a lot of exposure. I don't really think that it was all that highly anticipated because for the most part, because a lot of people thought that it was basically just going to be, you know, Manny Pacquiao has gone too far from that point. And, you know, Juan Manuel Marquez had already, you know, lost to Floyd Mayweather, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, if you add everything together, I would probably agree with that answer. Although in terms of action, I can think of a couple of different fights that probably, I don't want to say necessarily they surpassed Corrales Castillo 1, because that's pretty difficult to surpass. But there were a couple fights that I thought were on that level, like, you know, Rios Alvarado 1, Somsak Sith Chachawal versus Mayer Montefiore from 2006.
Let's not forget that one, yeah.
I mean, that was crazy. But not a lot of people knew about it, too. You know, to Ring Magazine's credit, the guys that they had for him at the time, you know, saw that fight and saw that it was a really, really, really good fight and put it that fight of the year. But in terms of all-out importance and, you know, everything added together, I would agree with your guys' answer.
And the best point you made was that no one expected it. We thought Pacquiao was just going to roll through him, you know, the weight jump, the, you know, all of that. We saw enough of that rivalry, customer fatigue, all those storylines put down underground when they started trading. It was great.
And we, you know, we thought the same thing going into the third fight, and it was probably the weakest of all four fights, but it clearly wasn't a Pacquiao, you know, steamroll by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of brings up this issue of, you know, what does it mean when you say fight of the year? And what is that, you know, and there's different viewpoints. And some people just think it's all-out slugfest brawl, whatever has the most action. And other people, you factor in, you know, the magnitude of the event. And as far as, you know, like you said, I mean, it was just the perfect way to end what I would consider the Pacquiao era from, you know, 2008 through 2013. I mean, where this guy just took the boxing world by storm and had so many memorable moments and fights, and obviously had great fights before that too, but really broke into the mainstream. I mean, this was just such a just classic way. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it better. And I think, you know, like you said, Brian, I mean, when he got hit with that big knockdown in the third round, what really made it so great was then that he came back and was just knocking Marquez around the ring and hurt him, and it was hitting him with clean punches and broke his nose and had him touch his glove
it
to the canvas.
It was old school. Yeah, it was old school Pacquiao.
Yeah, I mean, it was just and then what an ending. I mean, that's you know, it's right there for me with, like, Roy Jones Jr. getting knocked out. I mean, one of the most, you know, memorable and in some ways painful images that I've seen in a boxing ring, because you don't want a great fighter like that to get hurt. But it, you know, it kind of had to happen.
And I love the idea of old guy fights. I'm a sucker for old guy fights. And they never usually pan. You know, the theory is, oh, well, they've both lost enough where this is going to be a great fight. And everyone always points to Thrilla and Manila. You know, maybe it can be that. And old guy fights never usually pan out well. This was like the, and I know both these guys are still top 5 pound for pound at the moment the fight went on. But still, this was like old guy fighting at its finest.
Yeah, and just so much, so much history between the two of them, too, and such a great contrast in styles. I mean, they were just made for each other. And I also thought it was great once Pacquiao recovered his senses, I mean, the sportsmanship in the ring afterward.
Yeah.
You know, you look at clowns like, no offense, but Adrian Broner and Paul Malignaggi and the way that they conducted themselves, and then you see these guys like Marquez and Pacquiao. I mean, there's just this, like, nobility among them. And we always say, you know, boxers are warriors, and, you know, we use these, like, hyperbole, but these guys really embody all of that.
I
thought Marquez telling Pacquiao at the end, you're a great fighter, I thought that was one of my favorite moments, too.
Not to get lamply on us, but, I mean, you almost have tears running down your face. Every time I watch that replay, it's like the emotions all come back. It's just, that's boxing. That's why we watch, right? I mean, am I sounding
that's
like
exactly
an
why we
over-caffeinated, you know, loser here or what? Put me in my place.
No. Well, you know, speaking of the giddiness and stuff like that, and, you know, I kind of told the story as it was happening, you know, a lot of people probably weren't paying attention or didn't see it or whatever. There was, like, you know, 9,000 tweets per second on it, you know, when it happened and everything. But I just remember, you know, I was watching it here in my house, and I had just put my daughter to bed, like, right before the main event started. And so I was trying to be quiet, but, you know, I was doing, like, the type of, like, oh, type of stuff where I was, like, you know, screaming under my breath. And then finally when the knockout happened, and, you know, I don't have anything in particular against Manny Pacquiao. You know, I got a lot of shit before the fight because I said that I had Marquez winning all three of the first three fights, you know, thinly, but at the same time winning. So needless to say, I was kind of rooting for Marquez. And then when the knockout happened, I literally, like, squealed the most silent squeal you can think of. I was like, trying not to wake my daughter up, because I was like, you know, my wife was sitting right next to me, but not really watching the fight. And when it happened, she looked up and she's like, is he dead? Is he dead? And I was just like, holy shit. I didn't know what to do. So I have to agree. It wasn't just you. I think it was a lot of people.
It ended in the most shocking possible way. I mean, I don't think anybody had Marquez knocking Pacquiao out. Pacquiao has always had a chin, and, you know, they fought three times. Pacquiao knocked him down four times. It's just, he's been staggered, but he's always had a chin. He's never been knocked lights out like that. I think even as younger, when he got KO'd as a teenager, I think it was like body shot stuff.
Body shot.
That
body
was
shot.
Crazy. Brian, do you think Pac recovers from that? I mean, how do you see Pacquiao Rios playing out?
That's the storyline of that is going to be great. It's going to carry the promotion, and you know, we're all going to be on the edge of our seat to find out. I believe that that Pacquiao's not as done as the worst case scenario people would think. So I don't think he gets stopped or, you know, in any case. And I think that would be a legitimate ground to say maybe he should hang it up. I think he wins because Rios is coming up in weight again in his tailor-made form. But I do think we're going to see a little bit of vulnerability early on from Pacquiao. You know, I don't know about a knockdown, but he's, you know, he's going to get hurt, I believe. I think he's going to have somewhat of a last stand, and he's going to finish Rios, and it's going to be a great fight, and you know, the promotion in the what they can do after this fight with him is going to be, you know, they're going to have a lot of options. But I do think we're going to see the continuance of the end of Manny Pacquiao. I just don't think he's done enough yet to not be able to get past Rios.
Well, I think that you know, maybe I admit to being a bit of a Brandon Rios fan, especially after seeing the first Rios Alvarado fight live and then seeing the second one live. It's tough to not really be a fan of that, of the guy, unless you're obviously, you know, very, you know, put off by some of the things that were, you know, needless to say, recorded in earlier in his career, like when he was in Antonio Margarito's training camp, or Margarito was in his training camp, whatever you want to call it, and then they kind of mocked Freddie Roach, and you know, a lot of people kind of saw that and was just like, this guy is a piece of crap, and they don't like him because of that, and I understand. However, I think that if you look at Brandon Rios, like, just kind of look at those fights aside, he's a tough guy. He's the type of guy who's not really going to stop coming forward. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to hit him fairly hard to stop him, I think, which Manny Pacquiao is certainly capable of. But at the same time, I think that the real question here is, has Manny Pacquiao recovered? Are his legs okay? You know, there's been, even in, not just in after the fourth Marquez fight, but even in a couple of years leading up to that, they've talked about he had leg cramps, he had foot issues, you know, his legs would be hurting mid-fight. He'd be telling them, oh, you know, my calves hurt or whatever in the middle of the fight. So I think that these are legitimate worries for him, and I don't think that Brandon Rios is the type of guy that you can go into a fight thinking, ah, well, he's smaller than me, I'm going to be able to knock him out. I think he's going to have to really be on his game to win this fight handily.
I think you're right, and I don't mean to assume that, you know, Rios gets knocked cold, because I don't think you can knock out Brandon Rios. I really don't. So you make a great point there. I think it would have to come via a cut or him just taking so much punishment where it was just a referee stoppage to save him from any more, if it went that way.
Yeah, I would agree, and I would favor Pacquiao, let me put it that way, because I think that I don't know that Brandon Rios is going to charge forward and knock him out, you know, like Marquez did. I don't really know that he has that capability at this point. However, regardless, I guess my only point was just that he's not a guy to be taken lightly, even coming off a loss, because I don't think Manny Pacquiao has the type of style either to be able to do to Brandon Rios what Alvarado was able to do in the rematch.
Yeah,
I love Brandon Rios, and you know, a couple years ago, I mean, I thought he was a guy who really had serious star potential for an American fighter. Just the all-action style, and he's got an interesting personality. He's really outspoken. He pretty much says whatever's on his mind. You know, going into this fight, I always hate to kind of pull the quick trigger on, you know, is a guy taking too much punishment or that kind of thing. But man, I mean, he's taken some horrible just punishment over the last few fights. I mean, really, the two fights with Alvarado. And it's just, I look at a guy like Brandon Rios, and I really wonder how long he can continue fighting, even on the level that he's at right now, taking those kind of shots every fight. You know, I mean, as tough as he is, and, you know, the guy's got an incredible chin, but, you know, human beings are not meant to be punched in the head that many times. And he's a guy that I really wonder isn't going to kind of flame out at a pretty young age because of the style that he fights in.
I completely agree with you on that. He's almost has too many qualities that we love in a warrior, you know, for his own good, and his just willingness and the promoter's willingness to just, you know, give him tough fight one after another, no extended break, you know, no easy showcase fights. You can't come out of that without, you know, getting old at 29 years old eventually. It's just impossible.
Well, let me ask you guys a quick question about that fight, actually, about Pacquiao Rios. So I know that there was a little bit of a backlash, I guess, when the fight was made, because, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, Alvarado won the rematch. Don't you think that he deserves the fight more than Brandon Rios does? But then I guess the kind of counter argument to that, at least from what I was seeing, was that, well, Rios Pacquiao would probably make for a more exciting fight. So that's why we're making, or that's why they're making that fight. What do you guys feel about that? Do you think that Mike Alvarado, you know, deserved the fight more than Rios did? Do you think that we should be seeing that fight instead? What do you think?
I'm not always a fan of running it back and doing all three in a short, condensed period of time, because sometimes things can change over the years. Identities of the fighters can change, and sometimes it can change to hurt the potential of having a big third fight. But I think you need both fighters should have the opportunity to extend their brand and go for it. So in Rios's case, you know, I don't like that he's taken so many what could be damaging fights in a short amount of time, but he's got a chance to face Manny Pacquiao when Manny Pacquiao was still, you know, a pay-per-view draw like this. I have no problem with that, even with him losing.
Brian, sorry, I think you said, do you think Alvarado deserved the Pacquiao fight?
Over him?
Rather than Rios.
Yes. Specifically in that question, yes and no. You know, yes, yeah, because he won that fight, a very close fight, you know, the continuation of their rivalry, two very close fights. But, you know, wasn't there some concerns from Top Rank that Alvarado, you know, in terms of with the fight being overseas, is, you know, would he be, you know, wasn't there some outside concerns? He had the hand injury, of course, and, you know, and would everything be perfect with him living up to his side of the bargain professionally in that situation? I think there were some concerns there. But it's tough to say. You know, I mean, Rios Pacquiao is such a bigger fight because Rios' name is a little bit bigger than Alvarado's in my mind. And maybe in the matchmaking mind, they think that's an easier fight than Alvarado, who's bigger and showed, you know, a little bit more diversity in his boxing game in the last Rios fight.
Yeah, and I didn't have a problem
agree,
with it either.
Go ahead, James.
Well, I didn't have a problem with it either because Manny Pacquiao is coming off of a loss. So I know he's the big money fight, but he's not at the top of the pecking order boxing-wise anymore until he can, you know, get back and actually avenge himself against Marquez. So, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a bummer for Alvarado, but I mean at the same time, I think he's got a good fight coming up with Provodnikov that I expect Alvarado will win, and he's going to be right there to, you know, whoever comes out of the Marquez Bradley and Pacquiao Rios, he's going to get big fights down the road. I mean, it's, you know, it kind of goes, yeah, if by winning a fight should you get the best fighter or should you get the biggest payday? I'm not sure because Pacquiao's, you know, coming off a pretty brutal knockout loss, so it, he's not really like at the top of the division anymore.
It's a great point. It really is.
Well, I think that it's kind of also interesting that you have a fight like Ruslan Provodnikov versus Mike Alvarado, where, you know, in the perception of many, both guys got shafted in one way or another. For Provodnikov, a lot of people thought that he should have taken the decision against Tim Bradley. And then for Mike Alvarado, a lot of people felt like he should have been the one to get the fight against Manny Pacquiao. But, you know, for a fight against, you know, leftovers, as it were, I think it's a damn good fight. So, I mean, you know, from a fan's perspective anyway, it's a damn good fight. I don't know that it's necessarily what either guy was, you know, particularly looking for.
I think it's a great fight. I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, Provodnikov is pretty similar to Rios in the style that he fights in. And we've seen how Alvarado fought against that style. So I think it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, I want to see if Alvarado can, if he's going to stick with the boxing and try to, you know, because he's got, sometimes I think he's got more skill than he shows, you know, and he especially showed that in the second fight with Rios. And is he going to take that to the next level and maybe take a chance at winning this fight not as exciting as people think it might be? Or is he going to get hit and stand in there and just, you know, and just go toe-to-toe and prove he's a tougher guy? It sells itself. It's going to be a fantastic fight.
There's no way it couldn't really be. I mean, I think Provodnikov's the type of guy that applies so much pressure that I don't really know that Alvarado is going to have a whole lot of say in where the fight is fought.
Yeah.
Not that he's not good or he just won't have a choice, but Provodnikov's the type of guy that's tough as shit and is going to be pushing forward and trying to make the fight. So I think that it's fairly likely that we'll see a pretty good fight, or at least a kind of trench warfare type of fight.
Yeah, and I think, it's interesting looking at the Golden Boy Top Rank dynamic at 140 and 147, because it's like both sides of the bracket have all these fights potentially getting made, and they're all fighting each other. And the great thing is, since Pacquiao lost, he was obviously the top ranks A side, and Marquez has already fought Mayweather. No one's really demanding any you know, no one's out there saying, well, we need to get Mayweather Pacquiao. I mean, I think maybe in a year or two, whoever emerges from the rubble on both sides, that'll be a big fight again between the two promotional companies. But for now, I mean, we're pretty content to watch all these guys just fight each other.
And if these are the type of fights we're going to get, why not?
Yeah, and for Top Rank having what we thought was somewhat of a small cupboard in these, you know, the money divisions of 140 to 147, it couldn't have worked out any better for them to have these type of fighters where they can just keep matching them against each other, and each one is such, you know, compelling action fight, especially with Tim Bradley making the heel turn into an action fighter in the last fight, you know? I mean, do you think he's going to keep that style up to a certain degree moving forward?
My take on Bradley against Provodnikov, and I don't want to take anything away from Provodnikov because, I mean, he showed a lot that fight. But I did think that Bradley was off. I thought that he looked a little slower. I heard that he'd blown up 50 pounds or 60 pounds, you know, before he got into training camp. And I think he had no choice but to engage Provodnikov like that. I don't think that's his natural style, but he's obviously got a huge heart, and he's a tough guy, and he was willing to stand there and trade with him. And one of the things about that, you know, as noticeably – you know, damaged and stumbling as Bradley was in points in that fight, I mean, all you have to do is look at Provodnikov's face at the end of it, too. I mean, that was a war, and both guys doled out a lot of punishment. I think it was the fight of the year myself. I thought that was – I enjoyed that more than the Alvarado-Rios rematch. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think Bradley's a question mark. I mean, you take – you know, I'm interested to see how Bradley looks against Marquez because I think, you know, he took a hellacious beating. You know, there's a lot of these kind of – they're great fights in Top Rank, but you can't help but thinking, you know, was Pacquiao damaged goods? Is Rios starting to take too much punishment? Is Bradley a little damaged? I mean, really the only guys who aren't maybe is Alvarado at this point.
Good point. And it's interesting. Like you said, like Bradley took – he might have taken one of the worst beatings for a fighter that won a fight ever. I mean, like – there's guys that can stand, like in an Alvarado-Rios situation, they're standing and trading the whole fight, and it's ridiculous, but they sort of are a little more predisposed to have this ability to take it and not show that they're as hurt. I mean, Bradley looked like he was, you know, concussed and out like four or five times. How does that not slow you down in your next fight or shorten your career dramatically, right?
Yeah, he may have been unconscious more than he was conscious during that fight.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, you never see somebody go into that. You know, remember the old remember the boxing video games of the mid 2000s where they had that point where when you're on the verge of going down, the whole screen starts to shake, you know, and you start to, you know, you're about to go into sleep mode, and he must have been like that for half the fight. I mean, he was probably fight night games. Yeah, he fought the most consciously in a period of being unconscious in the ring that anyone's ever done. It was just ridiculous.
And you know, on top of that, I think that getting hurt early in the fight really, that was what kind of, like, screwed him in a way. Because a lot of people were like, oh, well, he elected to trade, and that was stupid. But, you know, Provodnikov came right out the gate and was kind of crawling right up in his ass there from the beginning. So I can't really say that, you know, when people say stuff like that, like, oh, well, you know, he just kind of chose to do so or, you know, whatever. I kind of looked like, to me, like Provodnikov was making him do it. Although you're right in that when Bradley was hurt, I mean, it wasn't like he was caveman flailing either. There, that point in the, it was either the first or second round where there was just like an extended sequence on the ropes where they just sat there like trading punches almost like Morales Barrera won, where like they just threw and they were like, you know, screw it. If I get hit, I get hit. We're just throwing punches. That was great stuff.
It was nuts. And, I mean, I've always thought that there was a good chance that Bradley didn't, you know, he came in maybe a little bit out of shape or he cut too much weight and he didn't quite have his legs. And Provodnikov hurt him before he had any chance to warm up and kind of get into his rhythm. Because, you know, naturally, I mean, I think Bradley's much quicker and in theory should have been able to just move around the ring and box and avoid most of those threats. But, man, he just got hurt so early. He really didn't have a choice but to fight the way that he did.
And I think part of it, though, was he thought he was going to just outbox and maybe even, you know, blow through this guy. You know, I think there was some form of underestimating of Provodnikov's heart and warrior mentality here. But I think Bradley made some decisions in there to stand and trade. Like, it wasn't so. It wasn't always that Provodnikov caught up with him. I mean, there was a ridiculous amount of bravado on his part, maybe to try to turn the tide of his brand, probably, because, you know, he wants to be an attractive draw to try to get to get the big fights. But I think the key of what made that fight was so great. Yeah, Provodnikov caught up with him, but I think there was a lot more of Bradley allowing too much action to go on. I mean, is that a cop-out?
I think you're right. I mean, I think that there were times when
it was a mix for sure.
He seemed to, you know, elect to do that. And I don't know if maybe it was the round Patrick was talking about. I remember it like the fifth or sixth round, but one of those, the last 20 seconds of the round, and Bradley just has his back on the ropes, and it looks like his eyes are closed, and he's just throwing punches and taking a, you know, and it was crazy. And at the end, when the bell rang, he's like screaming at Provodnikov and like flexing his muscles, and I mean, just totally, you know, macho. So it was a side of Bradley that we'd never seen. And, you know, that fight, to me, by the end of it, I mean, I think it was fight of the year. I thought it was a great fight. But, again, it was one of those fights that made me a little bit uncomfortable at the end, because you had to realize, like, how much just brutal punishment that Bradley had taken, and Provodnikov. But, we don't know his personality as well. I mean, we've seen Bradley on the airwaves for a while. We know he's a stand-up guy. I thought he got kind of a bad rap after the Pacquiao fight. You know, all these people criticizing him. It's not his fault that the judges messed up. And I've always thought Bradley's just a real gentleman, and I like his personality a lot. So, you know, at the end of that fight, I mean, seeing him, I mean, that's the kind of fight that you just think, like, man, that guy, that took years off that guy's life. I mean, that was crazy.
He had one of the best interviews afterwards in, like, the 2 days after that fight. I don't know if you heard it on ESPN LA Radio with Max Kellerman and Marcellus Wiley, and he just broke down deep into why he was willing to stand and trade like that, and just basically blamed it on his dad and the way his dad raised him, you know, with that military mentality, you know, and always motivated him to do more, even when he was, you know, at the complete point of exhaustion in his training. And he was like, yeah, Dad, this is your fault. And I just sat there listening to that, and the way he spelled it all out, like, man, this guy's crazy. You know, we don't think of him as, we think of him as this nice family man, but man, this guy deep inside is like, he's not even Holyfield. This is like a different level mentality on the inside, you know?
And to kind of piggyback off of that, you know, I also have to say that, number one, I've been a Tim Bradley fan for a handful of years, so, you know, take that into account here. But I also kind of feel bad for him in a way, because, you know, if you kind of in a vacuum look at the Pacquiao fight and then the Provodnikov fight, you know, if you look at those fights, it was, whether or not you thought that Tim Bradley won either of them, I really don't think that his stock should have gone very far down because of those performances, because they were gritty, ballsy, tough guy performances where he had to kind of gut out a number of rounds. And, you know, I don't really know about the veracity of, you know, him having two broken ankles and fighting Pacquiao like that. I think that was probably a stretch. He probably, you know, had some injury, but regardless, he was injured. But, you know, those were the type of fights that I think that I just don't see how you could see those fights and be like, ah, Tim Bradley, man, I hate that guy. Which is basically what happened after both fights, just because, you know, some judges, you know, in their eyes got it wrong. So I kind of feel for the guy a little bit.
Yeah, I think go ahead.
Well, I think it's kind of, there's like an element kind of, and the sport obviously is a violent sport, and, you know, there's an element of almost kind of barbaric to say, like, you know, oh, well, you got the Pacquiao robbery and, you know, you have a boring style. You have to prove yourself. You have to go out and get your ass kicked and get in this, like, exciting fight. And, you know, I don't like that. I mean, I thought it was a great fight and I enjoyed it. But, you know, I don't like this notion that, like, Tim Bradley has something to prove to the fans who are, you know, sitting on their couches comfortable, you know, just spectating. I mean, he had nothing to prove. I mean, I just don't like that idea of, like, oh, fighters need to be fighters have to be in action fights. That's basically like saying fighters need to get their ass kicked and need to take punishment and need to get punched in the head. I mean, I love an action fight if it happens organically, but no fighter should have to prove anything to any fan.
Yeah, he's had just that black cloud trailing him that just didn't make any sense, you know? That's why the comparison to Holyfield made so much sense, because it was just sort of like, how do you get down on this guy? Here's an American fighter who you know, can talk and, you know, looks the part of a badass and fights with his heart out. And It's hard to explain, and I think that's part of what fueled him to put out that performance he did against Provodnikov, and it's crazy how that dynamic builds over time.
Well, I think it still goes back to that Devin Alexander fight, which was an incredible disappointment for everybody, and I think the stain was on both guys for a while. I think Bradley's just coming out of that because of how awesome the Provodnikov was, but most people still aren't going to forgive Alexander for that, and Alexander for getting controversial decisions against Kotelnik and Matisse, you know, and... But it doesn't mean the guy should just try to go out and go out on his shield if that's not the style of fighter that he is. Just
yeah,
for our amusement, you know.
Well, I agree that I don't think that any fighter should necessarily feel obligated to go out and fight in a way that wouldn't be natural for him or in a way that puts him in more danger. And, you know, guys like Floyd Mayweather recently have said things like that. And I agree, you know, I'm not going to expect unrealistic things of fighters. However, but, you know, if I do think that they're boring or I don't enjoy their style, then, of course, I reserve the right to say so and not watch. You know, and for me, at least, that's my way of, you know, quote-unquote paying it back. The problem is that us hardcore fans, even when guys come on that we don't like or don't want to watch, a lot of the times we still do. So, you know, for me, it's I do, for the most part, agree with you, James, but I do think that it's at the same time, if a guy's going to be on TV and if a guy's going to be taking up TV slots, then there needs to kind of be at least some type of baseline, you know, want for entertainment there, you know, even if it's just like not clinching as much or something like that.
Yeah.
But
I know. And I mean,
continuously put guys on that are, you know, not entertaining. That's something else.
Yeah, I mean, none of this stuff's like black and white, cut and dry. I'm just saying in general, I prefer to look at boxing as a sport, and I respect the guys who can practice it at the highest level, hitting and not getting hit. I love action fights. I love when something organically, and that's why so many times when you put the best versus best, even guys who aren't in exciting fights, it turns into exciting fight, because when you match against an equal, a lot of times it has to play out that way. You know, but just in general, I mean, I guess you know, I don't like the notion that fighters should have to try to adopt a more fan-friendly style, because I think that's just kind of a pretty way of saying, you know, we want to see guys punching each other in the face. And, you know, that's, to me, I mean, yeah, that's what the sport's about, but it's about a lot more than that, too. You know, it's about defense,
for
it's
sure.
about footwork, it's about movement. And
in different
and
styles, yeah.
That's why Floyd Mayweather makes the money that he makes.
Yeah, boxing's so screwed up, man. I mean, we love it. It's the most scarred and bruised sport, and we love it. But man, it puts you in such a tough spot as a journalist, fan, admirer, lover, because you know there's always that gray area of guys taking too much punishment. We cheer them all on to be warriors, and then when they take too much punishment, we cringe and say, "Hey, get out of the ring and don't ever come back." And then there's that whole gray area between, do titles matter? We, you know, we push people to care about collecting titles and filling out their legacy by fighting everyone we want them to, but then at the same time, let other people get off the hook when all they care about is making their, you know, their $3 or $4 couple million pay-per-view chances and then getting out. So it's great. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I mean, obviously, it does create anyone with any kind of a moral compass. I mean, yeah, there's going to be like some conflict at times when you're a boxing fan. But I just feel like, you know, every other sport is designed for the best to fight the best, or the best to compete against the best, so that, you know, and that's the object. And I think that boxing would be better served following that model.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the bottom line, and that's how you get all the fans back in it. You know, identified champions facing the next guy in line, et cetera, et cetera. Oh
yeah, and,
man.
Well,
I have a question.
I have a question for you, Mr. Campbell, to think on, because I know you have to go pretty soon. But I was going to ask you, you asked me the other day what I thought my top 5 Arnold Schwarzenegger flicks were. So I was going to ask you what your top 3 or 5 boxing flicks are. So think on it for a second, and
yes.
I'll ask
By the way,
to
how the hell
again,
is Kindergarten
freely.
Cop not on those lists?
You know, well, this is a great debate. I could go 20 minutes on this topic because, you know, I love Arnold for the crazy over-the-top 80s ones that were just so ridiculous that they're so perfect to watch. You know, the best buddy flicks ever, Grab a Beer. But then he kind of threw us a curveball with things like Twins and Kindergarten Cop. Should we consider them on the same up, you know, on the same level as these ridiculously awesome flicks like Commando, where guys take machetes to the, you know, to the crotch, or should we maybe, you know, put those in a separate? You know, I don't know what to do here. You know, I stay up at night, you know, debating these type of things. I really do.
That's what I'm saying. I wake up in a cold sweat sometimes at about 4 a.m. thinking about this.
It's not a tumor. That's all I can say.
Well, boys have a penis, girls have a vagina. What are you going to do? But
it's a great flick.
Think on that, the boxing flick thing. And actually, real quick, I also wanted to ask you about some, I guess, more current event type of stuff. Did you wind up catching the Edwin Rodriguez versus Dennis Gracia fight from this last weekend?
I did. And holy crap, did I not see that coming. You?
Me neither. Well, Dennis Grashev trains here in San Diego, and if I'm not mistaken, I think he's trained by Manny Melchor, who was a former, I think, IBF strawweight champion, I believe. And in any event, he trains here in San Diego, and I thought fairly highly of him. He looked pretty good, you know, in spots, I guess, at least against Lucien Boutte. I think he's the guy who stopped Ismael Sulak. I didn't see that coming at all because Edwin Rodriguez, from what I had seen, had looked kind of, you know, sometimes good, sometimes pedestrian. But that was pretty crazy.
That's the best way
to
say
it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, great performance from Rodriguez, great win.
You know, he's been such a tease because you can tell, you know, he's got the size, he can box. You can tell there's a lot under there, but I really started to doubt it, that he just didn't have the gear, you know, in it to be able to put out that type of performance. And I certainly didn't see that coming in this random Monte Carlo tournament against, you know, a badass in Grachev. I didn't really, you know, I still don't believe it happened. Did it?
I don't know. I wasn't there, so I don't know if I'm buying it fully. I'll have to maybe pay a visit to his camp or something like that.
How about that crowd at Monte Carlo?
Hey, Gennady Golovkin was there in a tuxedo, so, you know, there's some high rollers there.
Yeah, he's playing
baccarat
after
nothing,
the fights.
The only other thing that gets Gennady Golovkin in a tuxedo is a good game of craps. So, you know,
exactly.
It's needless to say, high rent. All right.
I think
so now that you've had a minute
for,
or...
Oh, go ahead.
No, so, go ahead, man.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, I think it's a big step toward really convincing us that Rodriguez could be a legit contender at 168.
Yeah, I think he's got a chance now. You know, if he can put out a performance where, you know, not the same one blow guy out in the first round, but I think if he can be a little more aggressive, you know, and show a little bit more passion. I mean, he had his showcase fight on the big network against Donovan George, and remember that was like one of the worst fights I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was
that
there.
Was not good.
Oh, you, where was that, Chicago?
Rooting on the Chicago guy. It was in New York on the undercard of Martinez Macklin.
Oh, that's right.
All right, so now that you've had a couple minutes to think about it, lay on us your top three or five boxing flips.
All right, you know, at least 75% of me becoming a boxing fan was because my dad was obsessed with the Rocky movies, like anybody else, you know, who grew up in the 80s. So it's hard... You know, and I love movies, but I love more of, you know, I love 80s Seagal and Schwarzenegger flicks. I'm not like the guy who compares movies, you know, in terms of the genius of it and all the cinematic and all that. So, I, you know, a Rocky flick to me is the best thing ever. Rocky 3 and 4 are just, you know, they're just unreal. I mean, in so many different ways. And they touch so much of the ridiculous, excessive, unbelievably awesome side of the 80s. You know, 80s films that just make them perfect for me. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to be like, yeah, Raging Bull was the best thing ever. But I'm going to put Rocky 3 and 4 on my list. I'm going to put The Fighter because I'm such a Mickey Ward mark that it's just absolutely ridiculous. And a Mark Wahlberg mark. So it just, you know, it came together perfectly. And damn, a little sidebar. Is Good Vibrations by Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch the best wedding reception song to put on at any time ever? Or is it CNC Music Factory's first hit? I mean, really. You can take it and run with it.
You can't go wrong either way.
I might have to go with Word Up by Cameo. I don't know.
Oh, whoa. I didn't see that one coming. Not bad. So, you know, I'll put those on there.
Throwing it out there.
In my other one, I'll give you four. My other one is Cinderella Man, because I didn't think that was going to be a good movie, and I reluctantly saw it and was like, man, that, you know, they did it right. They did it right to try to pull in, you know, the whole categories of audiences, and I really liked it. You know, you can say what you want about the boxing scenes, but I thought it was a really touching movie. They did good with the story.
I thought it was a good movie, for sure. What did you say, James?
That was some good call. Good call. What about,
I thought Cinderella Man was a good flick. It was, you know, as a lot of people have said, you know, since it came out, it was, some parts were historically inaccurate, but whatever. And mm-hmm. as a movie, it was a good movie, and there were actually some good boxing sequences in there.
Yeah, they were shot differently, kind of awkward, but, you know, the whole package I thought was really good. They captured the despair of the Depression and all that. But you know what's the worst boxing movie, and maybe the worst movie of all time, is? It's Million Dollar Baby. And I'll fight anybody on this, because I have the ability to not know what's going on at times in certain realms of pop culture or even the news. There's just certain stories that just don't hit me. Like this Trayvon Martin thing, I just never really got connected into it and delved in to have an opinion. I was just sort of somehow avoided that. I avoided for like a year and a half knowing anything about Million Dollar Baby besides that it was a boxing movie with the chick from Karate Kid 4. And then, you know, let's not call it Karate Kid 4 because it never happened, right? But So I rented that thinking I was knowing not hearing anything. That all I heard was, you know, it's got so many nominations, this is going to be the best movie ever. What the heck happened for the first hour? I'm like, you know, it's all right. This is like a female version of Rudy. It's kind of cool. You know, there's a good dynamic between the trainer and fighter. Dude, this thing fell off the rails. It was the worst movie I've ever seen. And it was like you thought Pacquiao getting knocked face down was one of the biggest shocks we've ever seen in boxing. The end of this movie was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my whole life.
Tell us what you really feel.
I mean, just to not know what's coming, I didn't buy into the storyline and the whole, you know, I want nothing to do with it. Thank you. I said it.
Well, I'm a huge Hillary Swank fan, but I've actually never seen that.
Wow. I thought that I was going to be like the only one here. I literally watched that movie for the very first time like 2 days ago. Seriously.
Give me your thoughts.
I mean,
give it to me.
I did not like it very much. I mean, I thought that, Clint Eastwood basically played Clint Eastwood, and then Morgan Freeman pretty much played Morgan Freeman. Hilary Swank basically played a Southern version of Mia St. John or something like that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was not very good. I mean, the shot where she fell over and broke her neck on the stool, like, I laughed. It was kind of just like, really? What? I don't know. If that happened in real life, I would be devastated and I would feel horrible for whoever it was that it happened to. But still, it was just the way that it was shot, and then like just all of the just thick, stupid cliche all over everything, you know, about boxing with like the old black guy who's, you know, the kind of genius behind this, or like, you know, the retired fighter who's trying to blah, blah, blah. It was just, it wasn't very good.
And you're not even getting into the whole social side of it with the whole, you know, letting someone die in peace or all that stuff. I mean, to think I was walking into the female version of Rudy in a boxing movie and then to have the plot turn that way, I've never taken the DVD out of the player fast enough at the end of that. Thank you.
Yeah, it was basically Rudy meets Terry Schiavo. And yeah, I went there.
Exactly.
I went there.
You did go there. I didn't think you'd do that. But wow. I mean, come
on, Foley, get in on this.
Folster, get in on this.
I haven't seen it, man, but I mean, it sounds pretty brutal.
It's the most depressing thing that ever happened, all right?
Yeah, it wasn't good, dude. I never had seen it, and I didn't know that it ended with, like, her becoming, like, a quadriplegic, and then does Eastwood just do the old pillow on her face move, or?
Yeah, I don't even want to relive it, but you're right, yeah.
I don't know. Doesn't sound
it was a little ridiculous.
But I felt betrayed. But, you know. I felt betrayed that they had sucked me into this, you know? Forget not getting that 2 hours back. They had sucked me into a road that I was not planning on going down, that I did not sign up for, and I didn't agree, and it suddenly was all over me.
You wanted inspiring, and by the end of it, you were up on the roof contemplating ending it.
Yeah, exactly. And then everyone that talked me into, you know, oh, you got to rent this. It was one of the best movies. What, are you kidding me? But again, I love Marked for Death by Steven Seagal. It's like my favorite movie. So, you know, take that with what you know.
the Citizen Kane of Seagal movies.
Exactly, exactly.
For sure.
I just like how all Seagal movies have, like, an environmental twist to them. You know, like, he's like a former CIA agent who's, like, moved to Alaska and become, like, an environmentalist.
Yeah, on Deadly Ground.
That was awesome.
Was Marked for Death the one with Screwface? Was that Marked
with the
for
Screwface
Death?
Twins, dude. The twins. And
yeah,
remember the line at the
yeah.
end? Hope they're not triplets.
Yes.
Oh, that's just the best movie. That's just... And that's my favorite debate of all time with people that are as weird as me and like this. Which death was worse? Which Screwface twin died more ridiculously? You want me to recap it? Because I will, all right?
Well, you guys know...
Yeah, well,
you
know, we got the time.
You know Seagal taught Anderson Silva pretty much everything that he knows, fighting-wise.
He taught him that front kick that knocked out Vitor Belfort in that
yep.
fight. Did you see that ridiculous
yep.
just crane kick from
yeah,
the Karate
yeah, sure
Kid animal? I mean, that's crazy. Yeah, this guy sends it. His interviews, his mainstream mixed martial arts interviews with real reporters are some of the more unintentionally funny things I've ever seen because nobody takes himself more seriously than Seagal. It's just ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, even Van Damme
well,
started to kind of like parody himself, and Seagal's just not willing to go there.
Oh, no, no. And, that, and you know, it brings me back to the Screwface twins. Dude, would you rather take a, like, 16th century sword to the satchel and then basically get your head chopped off? Or would you rather get the eye gouge, backbreaker to the knee, like WWF style, where, like, the back literally broke, and then thrown down an elevator shaft where your body ends up over basically going on a spike at the bottom?
Oh, man, that's a tough choice.
A choice we hope we'll never have to make.
Yeah, I mean, that's the 80s for you. It was great. Ugh.
Yeah, exactly. In the 80s, everything either ended on a spike or, getting eye gouged or something.
With a synthesizer soundtrack.
I mean, are you familiar with that movie? Do you remember the scene where they're playing dominoes in the warehouse?
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Let me take 2 minutes of your life that you'll never get back. So Seagal gets revenge against the Screwface guy, you know, because they had gotten to Seagal's sister. So he gets some revenge. He takes out all their henchmen, whatever. So the word gets back to Screwface number two. He's sitting playing dominoes with his boys in this empty warehouse. Somebody whispered to him, and he goes, "Who be that? The white boy Hatcha?" Which I'll translate. That means, "Who did that? The white boy Hatcher?" Meaning Seagal. So Screwface is so pissed that he stands up, flips over the dominoes table, breaks off a leg of the table, and then takes out his own guys with the leg of the table because he's so upset. That's awesome.
That's a power move.
That's unbelievable. Sometimes I wonder if, like, Aram used to do that back in the day in the Top Rank offices, you know? And that's how the Cold War started.
Aram's one of those guys. He's probably done something like that. You know, he's like the old Don who just seems like he's just kind of ruling his empire. But, like, you know, when he was younger, he just, like, definitely, like, fucked some people up somehow.
Yeah, like, I mean, we know that Don King stomped a couple guys to death. What's going to come out of Aram's closet when it's, you know, when it's all said and done?
A lot of skeletons with some cobwebs on them.
Well, I've heard somebody say that he was the biggest Jew to come out of Harvard. But I don't know if that's true or if that's not true. Please tell me you guys remember Oscar saying that.
Oh yeah.
Wow, I was totally excommunicated from the conversation there for like a brief moment because you guys didn't know what I was
he's
talking
an,
about.
He's an anti-Semite.
Where are you going with this? Where is this going?
Yeah. Oscar was operating under racism's okay if it's about white people.
Yes, which, yeah.
Well, he did also say that black dudes can't take it to the body. So,
well, we go to Oscar
for social,
yeah, interesting insights into sociology and things like that. So,
hey, now that we're way off the tracks, I got questions for you guys.
What do you got? Fire away.
Because I love this show. You think I'm just humoring you up, but I told you, this show got me through a long trip at an airport one time, you know, a couple of layovers. I found myself in Detroit taking down way too many cheese dogs and just, you know, some cheese conies and just being – I just got so deep into the show, and I was like, this is awesome. Now it's sort of like I spread it out during the week. It's sort of my staple, like, drive to work in the morning. You know, I'll get, like, 20 minutes out of it, you know, and then I'll basically get through a whole week. So you're previewing a fight for a whole week for me. But I always picture – not to kind of sound like the old, you know, chat rooms of the mid-90s, like, you know, hey, what are you wearing? But I always picture that you guys, like, are in these elaborate setups because, you know, we don't know each other. What, you know, I get, like, two pictures you've ever put up on Twitter or something. I haven't run into you guys at a fight. You know, I don't know you from anything. All I know is that this guy – where does Patrick get off? What size is your satchel to have a beard like that? Because it's just the best thing that ever happened. But secondly, I picture you sort of, like, sitting in, like sort of like, you know, hospital scrubs with, like, because there's always a bird chirping in the background. So I always picture him sort of like sitting on top of your head while there's like maybe like gerbils and ferrets kind of crawling around the beard as you're doing the show. And it's awesome, you know, and that sort of just animates my mind as I'm listening to it. And then I always picture the Folster like in a college dorm, not a dorm, but like a frat house, like second floor. He's kind of sitting there in sweats, like playing like some like outdated video game, like James Bond on Super Nintendo or something awesome like that.
GoldenEye.
Yeah, GoldenEye. And there's some 18-year-old co-ed coming in wearing like his dress shirt and nothing else, feeding him like a bowl of cereal. And it's, you know, and that's sort of
man,
the...
my wife would be upset about that. But, yeah, Patrick broadcasts out of an aviary, actually. And, yeah, I'm just in the frat room, man. I got my Pink Floyd poster on the wall, the 6-foot bong on the floor.
Oh,
exactly. Got my game, my setup here, you know, Xbox, N64.
And I took an informal poll, and Middle America has the same, you know, expectations of where you guys are during the show. So you might want to live up to those personas a little more.
Yeah, definitely.
Well,
definitely.
I'm not sure what the latest Gallup poll has said, but my beard is essentially like Ace Ventura's house.
Oh, dude, is it
like,
well, getting,
you know,
longer?
I shaved it like a week and a half ago because I wanted to start anew, and it's really hot. But it's going to be coming back, and it's already like, you know, it's already more than stubble, and that was like not even, it was like a week ago. So it's coming back. Don't worry.
First of all, how dare you? Because the last time I thought you shaved it when you put on an outdated Twitter question, I was like, are you serious? You're gonna build this thing up and then just get rid of it? And then you're like, no, that's an old archive stock photo. Don't worry about that. This thing's hitting the floor. Don't worry. And now, oh, yeah, I'll just shave it this week.
I borrowed that picture from Getty Images, but no, it had to happen. You know, for there to be rebirth, there has to be death. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Maybe I just have such beard envy because I couldn't grow like, I mean, remember that mustache Oscar used to have, like, in the Olympics? It was sort of similar.
Oh, yeah.
It's similar to Dwayne The Rock Johnson's mustache that he had when he was playing football at Miami. It's just, like, the worst thing ever. I couldn't even grow that. Like, I would strongly consider rubbing the clean or the clear on my cheeks just for one cycle to be able to grow, like, a tenth of a Patrick Connor beard.
I hope Victor Conti's listening because, you know.
No, I'd go with me. I'd go to Mimo if I were you.
Oh, yeah, that guy's
He's got the good stuff.
Finding Memo. That's my favorite Disney flick.
Yeah, I actually hate shaving myself, so I actually usually rock, like, the Max Kellerman perpetual, like, 5 o'clock shadow.
Oh, I'd kill for that, too.
I almost never actually shave with, like, shaving cream. Just do the old trim it down move.
Well, dude, how'd you trim the beard, then?
That's seriously what it came down to for me, is I just hate shaving. Like, and I, you know, I'll sound like a little bitch here, but I have sensitive skin on my face, so shaving is, like, shaving every day, that's not really an option for me. But then, of course, as the legends, you know, floated through the land and the common folk were like, oh, my God, is that the beard? Then it just kind of took on a life of its own, and I kept it.
Now, are you...
It's a signature look.
Yeah, and that's why I imagine animals that aren't allowed as pets hanging from the beard during the show. Is that ever true? I mean, you are you a veterinarian? Give me the background here.
I'm not a veterinarian. I'm a veterinary technician. And so basically I can do just about everything a vet can do aside from like diagnosing things or surgery. But I still do a lot of things. So that's my day job. And I do that, you know, 40 hours a week. And the other time I'm taking care of my daughter and, you know, watching fights when I can, et cetera, et cetera. But I live in Pacific Beach, California, which is near the beach in San Diego. And I live in a really small, like, beach bungalow house. But I am indeed surrounded by animals because I have a whole shitload of them. Not like hoarder status, but I do have a lot of animals.
Most of them are still alive.
So the official TBQR... Is that bird part of the show that sort of chirps in every once in a while? Is that a random occurrence?
There's literally like populations of parakeets that like roam the beach over here, and so it'll get loud sometimes. And I'm being serious. I'm not joking.
Oh, the one fan like still listening, you know, this deep in the show is loving this, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I hope nobody was coming
for
to the
show diehard
about boxing. So,
if you wanted to hear about pulling the plug on life and, you know, debating which Jamaican assassin was killed worse, this is your show.
Is that your number one? Go ahead, Pat.
Go ahead.
No, I got it.
I was going to say, yeah, well, if you wanted to come here to find out whether or not, you know, I'm a friend to the Jewish community.
We got that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chihuahua. I'm going to be getting some calls in the next couple of days, and I'm going to try to lay low, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I was wondering why you were wearing that, like, white robe and hood when I met you in Vegas, but this explains
it's a lot. It's the style. What are you going to do?
Brian,
well,
you got time for another quick one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do it. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, like, how you got started in this whole business. And...
Dude, I'm living the dream. You know,
Are you at the conference table right now?
Yes, I am actually.
You might want to hype that up too.
In an undisclosed location, I am at the Worldwide Leader, but. You know, I'm biggest fan, just like anybody, you know, total. I lucked into a black, you know, those black cable boxes, they just call them black boxes where you get free pay-per-view.
Yeah.
I lucked into that at the right time in life and basically went on like a 12-year run of watching every pay-per-view and never paying once. And you can't not just build a foundation for being the biggest fan ever. And I'm from Connecticut. I'm from, you know, the great, well, use great sparingly, but the great working class town of Naugatuck, Connecticut, where you work in a factory if you're lucky, and right down the road from ESPN, and was lucky in my late 20s to eventually get a job here as an editor. And I've just kind of been climbing the ladder for the last 7-8 years, and just really like 2 years ago just kind of put my ducks in a row and just made a run at sort of saying, I want to be a boxing writer. This is what I want to do. So, you know, how is this going to happen? And you know, what doors are open? And I've got the best bosses and editors ahead of me, on top of me and in front of me, and I've just sort of been lucky enough to kind of carve out a little niche, helping out here and there. I'm an editor by day. Like, by day, I'm editing the boxing and MMA pages, and been doing that for about a year, and that's just a dream come true. And then I'm allowed to write on the side, you know, almost as much as I want, and it's just been one door after another opening up, and it's just, I'm living the dream. That's it.
Definitely, man. And a couple innovations that have gone on since you started. You're now doing a Tuesday chat.
Yes.
To accompany Dan Rayfield's Friday chat, and also those Making the Rounds videos that you guys are doing,
which
are great. So it seems like they've really expanded the content in the last like 6 months or so.
Yeah, you know, and it helps that I joined the group as an editor, and then I'm able to add a lot on the other side, you know, creatively and as a writer, and it's just sort of like the ideas came together at the exact time that I came in there. So it's been perfect. I mean, we're putting out the weekly show, recapping the news and all that, and the Tuesday chats is like the dream goal of the business. I mean, it's the most fun thing I do in boxing every week. It's just,
are you known as BTM?
No, I haven't officially gotten that. I haven't really acquired a moniker on par with the great DTM.
Dude, those self nicknames you were throwing out on the emails leading up to this like appearance. I mean, you got plenty of material.
Maybe I should bring that in.
You
want to
enlighten the listeners on your because I was dying last night when I read that.
Oh, maybe I should go as really the Cam Man, right? You know, because everyone can get it. I mean, I don't think anyone's had that nickname before. So,
all right,
you know.
maybe it was better in writing. Maybe it was better in writing.
Yeah, no, it was a lot better in writing. The timing was perfect. It doesn't recycle well. No.
No, that was huge.
Yeah, just like Broner's jokes. They really, you know, after the first time, it's not, you know, or not at all. Yeah.
Well, are you a big fan of Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, are you a big fan of the Can Man himself?
I actually am. You know, and the antics get to me as much as they get to anybody. I don't tend to get, like, physically upset like people do. You know, I'm in love with his talent, especially as being, like, you know, one of the few two or three guys that have next in the sport. And I think that he's mastered the ability to be irritating, and it's just going to continue to fuel his his stock and his, you know, his ability to draw viewers. I mean, his numbers on cable are pretty ridiculous his last few fights. You know, even when he fought like Gavin Reese, I mean, they had, you know, a real high turnout there tuning in. And I think that I don't know, you know, I think he's for real in terms of, when I say for real, I mean for real on the highest level. I mean, I don't, you know, he's not Floyd Mayweather by any means, and there's you know, but I think that he's on pace to, yeah, I'm really high on his talent.
It sounds like you don't feel that same way about Canelo, or am I putting words in your mouth?
He surprised me on the Trout fight. I think he's a lot closer to his ceiling, yeah. You know, I think he's going to be around a long time and be a fun fighter who makes, you know, big fights. But, yeah, I don't think he has years to grow. I think, you know, the 22-year-old is a deceiving number when he's been a pro since 15 years old, you know. So he's got, you know, I think he's closer to being as good as he can be. But I'm going to give him room to surprise me, you know.
Are you a VO guy at all?
I try to use it every morning. But but my supply is running low. But, you know, I mean, is there a more fun guy to watch fight than Victor Ortiz?
That explains it. You always look so shiny on those Making Rounds videos.
Yeah, I've incorporated it into the makeup department that they have. You know, I hit the makeup chair before going on the air, and I've asked them if they can add the VO line in.
And you also only play basketball now with jeans, no shirt, and a backward baseball cap, right?
And no draws as well, which is a key part of that look.
And kind of awkwardly wave at the girls walking by.
Oh, yeah. And then just, yeah. And again,
and all the other dudes in the court are like, damn, who is this guy?
Oh, that's just gold. That commercial is just gold. Like, he had no idea what he was putting out.
No.
It's just gold.
He's a comic genius. I mean, he really is. I know it's not intentional, but, you know, everything that guy does is funny.
He needs to be in more fights. He needs to be more active. I mean, it's a talking point waiting to happen. I mean, he gives you water cooler moments, you know? He's the
best. Yeah, and that's my take on the Mayweather fight, you know? It was just like, well, hey, yeah, on one hand, it kind of sucked that that's how it ended. But on the other hand, I mean, how much awesome fodder was there to talk about afterwards?
Exactly.
I thought it was hilarious. I laughed my ass off.
Yeah, that was great for the sport. And everyone thought it was horrible for the sport, but it was fantastic, you know?
And I don't think it really.
Bad,
I mean, I think the Lopez loss hurt Ortiz's
awesome.
Cred a lot more than that did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
You think? I don't know. I mean, can he bounce back and be a real fighter, or is he just going to be this you know, poor man's Tyson-esque, you know, flame out waiting to happen every time he fights?
God, I have no idea.
Because he was freaking possessed against Andre Berto, and
he looked awesome.
Brought me back in. Yeah, he brought me back in for a
fight.
That's
the thing.
I remember you saying you were at that fight.
Literally anything can happen. Anything can happen when he fights. Like, literally anything. If, like, you know, something, I don't know, like a ninja pops out from underneath the ring and then, like, you know, slams his opponent with, like, a metal chair. If that happened at a Victor Ortiz fight, I'd be like, it's Saturday on, you know, Victor Ortiz night. Like, I wouldn't be surprised.
And I was at that Berto Ortiz fight, and that was one of those special moments. Remember the you know, of course, the oh my god Emmanuel Stewart, you know, the second knockdown in that sixth round. That was the only time ever covering a fight that everybody on press row stood to their feet, and the third row of press row, you know, or if you're at a bigger fight, the back two rows of press row sort of have the people that, like, don't even bring a laptop, you know what I mean? They're dressed in, like, shorts and a t-shirt. You know, they have a website or whatever, but they're not really there to cover the fight. These guys were standing on their chairs at that moment, like throwing their hat in the air, like jumping up and down. It was just like one of those, like, I can't believe this just happened moments, and it was fantastic to be present for. One of the more unprofessional moments I've seen professional writers ever.
Yeah, it was a solid fight.
You know, it's too bad what's happened with his career since then, but he's definitely provided us with a lot of entertainment. And, you know, the way he accepted...
Lopez fight was pretty fun.
Lopez fight was great. And, you know, the way he accepted the Robert Guerrero's challenge, did you guys see that?
Yeah.
Just fantastic.
Well, every single person in the Golden Boy stable, he'd make a good fight against, you know? And he'd make a watchable and marketable fight against.
I think Amir Khan would be awesome. I think Ortiz probably knocks him out, but who knows? I mean, with
that
those two guys.
That fight's been on my short list of three fights I need to see going back like 3 years. I mean, I would give so much to see that fight. It works for me so well in terms of the dynamics.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Victor Ortiz jokes are like the low-hanging fruit for like the people who like to make boxing jokes, but we'll pick it all the time because it's easy and it's still funny. But even so, you know, most of us are willing to admit that when he fights, it's usually a spectacle one way or another, and we're probably going to watch. And so, you know, you have to, you know, at least respect that. I wish you were a little bit more active, though, and so it kind of makes me question how serious he is about, you know, committing to fighting. I don't want to, you know, put too much weight into the interview he said after, you know, the Maidana fight, but it does make you think, I think.
Well, it's interesting because if he was busier, he might luck into a Mayweather rematch. You know, like if he was busier in stopping a couple decent names or getting past the guy, suddenly that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to see that per se, but they can sell that fight. You know,
I think
like maybe
it could definitely happen. If let's say he beat Guerrero and he avenges one of his losses, beats either Lopez or Maidana, I think he's right there in that mix. He's really, I mean, I've always thought Ortiz was a really talented fighter physically, and he's got power and, you know, he's a good boxer, but he doesn't exactly have that intangible that you'd like to see from a real, you know, world champion level guy.
And he, people forget how much of a prospect he really was. Like before, I remember
super hot.
The day before the Maidana fight, SportsCenter, the real ESPN SportsCenter, did a 3-minute feature on him. And it was basically like, you know, a produced feature of interview with Oscar De La Hoya saying, this guy's the next one. He's the special one. He reminds me of me, you know, whatever, this southpaw with power. And I remember at that point, I knew a little bit about who Victor Ortiz was. It wasn't like I was necessarily had followed his path. I knew his name, that he was kind of hot. I had heard of this, you know, Maidana warrior. But I remember being like, wow, maybe this guy's like even more than I thought he was. Like, this is crazy. This guy's on SportsCenter. And then he, of course, melted down in his biggest opportunity to get a big push. You know?
Yeah, I kind of feel for a guy like that, but at the same time, I don't know. I'll still joke about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, that whole thing bothered me too, because at a certain point, it's like, what more do you fans want? I mean, that was a great fight. It was just great action, you know, multiple knockdowns both ways. The guy was starting to get his ass kicked. He pulled out of the fight. He said some things in the post-fight interview. I mean, I like guys being honest and being candid, and I had no problem with what he said. I mean, don't you think every fighter after a fight like that is going to kind of question what he's doing? A young guy like Victor Ortiz, who probably doesn't quite have the mettle that some of these other guys have. I mean, you know, we all saw his self-doubt and everything like that, but I had no problem. I thought people jumping down his throat for that interview after that fight was ridiculous. And it's not like he quits in the first round, you know. Same thing with Jose Cito Lopez. I mean, he always puts on a show. They're great fights. You know, I don't want to see the guy get killed in there.
I didn't think it was a good sign, but I do think that also, you know, people made a little bit more of it than they needed to. You know, that's why I said I don't want to put a whole lot of weight on it, just because we've talked about it before. When guys start saying funky stuff right after they've been stopped, you know, it's kind of like, well, are we really going to be, you know, like analyzing what they're saying? You know, it's a little bit ridiculous in my opinion.
Yeah, you almost can't put the microphone in front of a guy who lost in that situation. We learned that with Juan Ma. You can't do that.
Unless you want to entertain us.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was pretty awesome.
We have about 3 minutes left, so if either of you guys have any questions, or James, if you have anything else to ask Mr. Campbell, get it in.
Man, I guess I just want to say thanks for coming on the show. Oh, I guess if you have one quick second, what do you think about this middleweight division with Gennady Golovkin and Martinez kind of at the end of his line? How do you see that whole situation playing out?
I'm really excited, you know, especially if Golovkin can draw Martinez into a fight. And there's some people that are just sort of dismissively saying, you know, Martinez is too old, forget about it, whatever, why do that? But, you know, I believe in the handing. You got to beat the guy. I believe in that whole thing. And I'm on that porch where I'm saying, I don't think Sergio's as shot as people think. I think he's just, you know, he's slowing a little, but he was more hurt and really wasn't taking the Murray fight as seriously as he should have. But I think, you know, everyone doesn't think Golovkin's going to get in the ring with anybody because he's going to be so avoided, but I think he's on a good line right now. If he can fight like the Martin Murrays, then maybe fight like the Danny Gills, and then get himself in a position to fight Martinez, and then you have potential pay-per-view on the HBO side opportunities with maybe Chavez or Ward. You know, I think that Golovkin is the goods. I think he can get through these guys. I think he can get through an older Sergio and knock him out. And really the true test for me, you know, of course I want to see him in against a slick boxer. I want to see him in against a guy who can take a punch. But the true test for me is Ward. And I hope Ward stays around long enough at 168, and that can eventually be a really big fight in like a year and a half.
Yeah, great call.
I agree. Yeah, I think that it's I would rather have the fight happen than not, although I wouldn't be devastated if it didn't happen.
Yeah, because name one person who's going to give Ward who could potentially give Ward a problem. Like, you can't, right? Can you? You can't do it.
Yeah, not really. Well, we have about a minute left, so I guess I'd just like to make sure I take that time to thank you, Brian Campbell, for coming on our show and shooting the shit with us for a little bit, because it was fun. And anybody who is not familiar with who Mr. Campbell is, he's works for ESPN, writes, and also does basically a web series for them. And so check it out.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Oh, guys, thanks a lot. My pleasure. Big fan of the show. I really appreciate you getting me on here and letting me be long-winded and talking with you.
Thanks, we appreciate it. Well,
yeah, it was our
check
pleasure.
Out, also, please check out thatlefthook.com that James writes for, and, of course, queensburyrules.com that I write for. And thanks, everybody, so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Take it easy.